Okay, this is Bio 241, and this is October 27th. Sorry, I had to start talking because otherwise the microphone would turn itself off, and I couldn't tell if it was working or not. Okay, so let's see. We do have a test coming up. We've covered all the material for the next test. So the chapters that will be on the next test are 9, 10, and 11. So 9 is autonomic nervous system, 10 sensory physiology, and 11 endocrinology, right? Want to make sure we're all on the same page. And the test was scheduled to be on the 29th, which is Thursday, coming up on Thursday, but we put it off, unfortunately, to November 3rd. Okay? So you get to study over the weekend. I suppose that's not such a big deal. All right, so everybody knows that November 3rd you have a test over 9, 10, and 11. And then the only other thing that I know that's happening is on the 10th, my boss is coming in to give a student evaluation of instructor day. So that will take a couple minutes at the beginning of the semester. I'm sure you all have been through that at on this campus or other campuses, right? So you just might want to mark down to be here on the 10th so you can fill out information regarding that. So don't skip out on the 10th. All right. So today we're going to start a new chapter, chapter 12, and it's muscle. So the first part of this chapter is just a strict, complete review of what you learned in anatomy. So I'm not going to go over it in a lot of detail, but I do want to, because I want to get onto the physiology of how skeletal muscle works compared to how cardiac muscle works and compared to how smooth muscle works. So how many different kinds of muscle are there? All right. Very good. A lot of people said three because you learn that in anatomy, plus I just got done saying that. All right, so we're going to look at a little bit at muscle structure. We'll look at the synapse between a neuron and a muscle, which we call the neuromuscular junction, review what a motor unit is, the structure of a muscle fiber. What the heck is a muscle fiber anyway? That's a muscle cell. That's right. All right, then we'll look at contraction, characteristics of contractions, neuronal control, and then look at a couple other different kinds of muscle. All right, so make sure that you can find your anatomy books or use your present text to go over the anatomy of a muscle. All right, so here we have a muscle that's attached to a bone, and what is that connection called?
Tendon.
That's a tendon, right? Muscle to bone connection is a tendon. What kind of tissue is that? Yeah, it's connective tissue. And even specifically, you should know there's lots of different kinds of connective tissue, so it's dense, regular connective tissue. If you want to go and take a look at a micrograph of what that looks like, that probably wouldn't be a bad idea. But you should at least know the chemical compound that's responsible for giving strength to this kind of tissue. What's the chemical compound? Yeah, it is collagen. And where do you find collagen at? Is it inside the cell or outside the cell? Yeah, what do we call that space outside the cell? That's the matrix. So hopefully some of this is coming back to you a little bit, right? And in order to rebuild those collagen fibers, maybe you didn't learn this in anatomy class, but this is kind of interesting to know. To rebuild collagen when you damage a tendon or a ligament or any kind of tissue that has collagen in it, you need a vitamin. Anybody know what vitamin you need to rebuild collagen, to grow collagen? It's vitamin C. That's right. So when you're recuperating from an ankle sprain or something like that, you should have plenty of vitamin C in your system. All right. And then we can see some other connective tissue sheets around this whole muscle. For instance, this could be like the brachialis, for instance, or coracobrachialis. All right. So this is just a gross muscle. It's covered with fascia, right, which we call the epimysium. And the building block of this whole muscle, you can see these formations right here. These are what we call bundles or fascicles. Okay, and surrounding the fascicles, you have the perimysium. And if we just look at one fascicle right here, we see that the building block of a fascicle is a muscle fiber or a muscle cell. So this is not really drawn to scale because these would be microscopic. And then surrounding every muscle fiber, we have the endomysium. All right, so here we can see an endomysium that's going to surround every particular cell. Furthermore, here's a cell. Let me straighten out my arrow cursor here so I don't drive you nuts. All right, so here is a muscle fiber right here. Furthermore, we can break down a muscle fiber into some organelles that are specialized for contraction. What are the organelles called inside of a muscle cell that are specialized for contraction? And we see them right here. These are myofibrils. So think of a myofibril like being a mitochondria, but what does a mitochondrion do? What does a mitochondrion do? It's an organelle inside a cell that is responsible for making ATP. Myofibrils are organelles inside skeletal muscle cells that are responsible for contracting or shortening. Right, so here we see, you could count them up, but I see four myofibrils right here. So they kind of resemble muscle fibers inside a fascicle, and it kind of resembles fascicles inside of a muscle. So you should be able to go up and down these different levels of organization within a muscle cell. Furthermore, a myofibril can be broken down into some building blocks as well. And these are the proteins associated with contraction or shortening. And those proteins are what we call filaments or myofilaments. And now we have to learn some specific names of myofilaments. Right? What are some specific names of myofilaments that you learned in anatomy? Okay, actin and myosin. One's thick, one is thin. Right? Okay. The other thing that we see on this muscle cell is that it is multinucleated. Because at one point in time, a muscle fiber was hundreds of cells, right, and that fused together to form this one really long fiber. Okay. All right, so when we look at muscle, skeletal muscle underneath the microscope, immediately we're struck with these stripes right here. And these stripes are what we call, go ahead, tell me, striations. So some muscle is striated and other muscle is not. What are the two kinds of muscle that are striated? Can you remember? Skeletal and cardiac muscle. But because they have the same kind of appearance, they have the same kind of structure inside of them, namely the arrangement of actin and myosin myofilaments, which is what we're going to look at next, is very similar. Smooth muscle does not have striations, so it does not have the same kind of arrangements of actin and myosin inside the cell. All right, so for skeletal muscle, notice that the cells are long and linear. They're not branched. They're multinucleated, and they're completely striated from one end to the other. Okay, so one of the characteristics of muscle is that it is excitable. It's an excitable tissue, and you're going to see that it has some similarities with axons that we've looked at before. And it's not on your next test. That was on the second test that you've taken already. But what allows an axon to transmit an action potential from the axon hillock all the way down to the axon terminus? What's special about the membrane of an axon? It has something. Okay. Yeah, that's outside the cell. A myelin sheath is what we see outside the cell. But even if we have an axon that doesn't have any support cells around it, it has something special in the membrane of an axon that it doesn't have in the membrane of the soma or dendrites, for instance. It has ion channels. Yes, I think we're getting hot. But there are ion channels in dendrites in the cell body, but a different kind compared to what's in the axon. Okay. Ah, the voltage-gated channels. Voltage-gated channels allow the axon to transmit an action potential, right? It's the ligand-gated channels that receive signals from other cells, but it's the voltage-gated channels. All right, so that's going to be the similarity that we're going to look at right now. Okay, so here is a connection between a nerve, and you can see this is a nice peripheral nerve because here I see a Schwann cell that has wrapped itself around this axon. All right, so an action potential comes down this axon, hops from node to node because of voltage-gated channels at the nodes of Ranvier. And then the axon terminus depolarizes. Now look at this very broad axon terminus right here. It is glued to this muscle fiber. All right, so you can see that even the axon terminus right here even inserts itself into a dimple inside the muscle cell membrane. So this is really kind of the only difference between the neuromuscular junction and the other synapse that we've looked at before. Okay, the synapse between nerve cells is missing some of these little structures right here, which we call the motor end plate, because when an action potential comes down one axon and stimulates the postsynaptic cell, the neurons don't move. They don't try to pull apart. All right, but when a motor neuron stimulates a muscle, what does a muscle do? It contracts, and it might pull away from the nerve, and if it were to do that, then the nerve would no longer have control over the muscle. So the nerve has to be fixed to the muscle much more tightly so that it doesn't dissociate. All right, so everything that you learned about a synapse relates to the neuromuscular junction, except for some of these special connections that keep the axon terminus securely fastened to muscle when it contracts. All right, so here is the axon terminus. You can see it embedded in the muscle cell, and you can see a lot of mitochondria. It's a very ATP requiring process, synaptic transmission, because you have to be pumping calcium around through different membranes, for instance, moving vesicles around inside the cell. These are all active processes. We also see synaptic vesicles that are containing the neurotransmitter. All right, so what's the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction? Maybe in anatomy you learned that. I don't know if I mentioned that specifically in this class, but it is acetylcholine. All right, so acetylcholine is it. That's the neurotransmitter. And so there, that means that this is a nice cholinergic neuron, and the receptors are, what are the two kinds of cholinergic receptors you're familiar with? The two main classes. Yeah, nicotinic and muscarinic. These are nicotinic receptors right here. And what's the classic form of a nicotinic receptor? All right, what's the kind of form? Is it a G protein coupled? It's just a nice simple ligand gated channel, right? Okay, so I don't have any pictures to show you, but in the previous chapters, right, that was probably an exam figure that you had to memorize at one point in time. All right, so synaptic transmission works pretty much the same way. Action potential comes down, all right, and depolarizes the membrane of the axon terminal. That allows calcium to enter this the motor neuron. That causes the docking and the release of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And then it diffuses across the synaptic cleft, binds to that nicotinic receptor, which then allows sodium to enter the muscle cell. And what happens to the electrical property of that muscle cell when sodium enters? It depolarizes. Okay. Now, notice the extent of this neuromuscular junction. It's huge compared to the typical kinds of synapses that we were looking at. So any time an action potential comes down the motor neuron, right, it causes a threshold stimulus in the muscle cell. It's never subthreshold. It releases so much acetylcholine. There are so many nicotinic receptors right here. So much sodium enters the cell that it always reaches threshold. All right, so this skeletal muscle cell, when there is an action potential on this motor neuron, can never decide on its own whether an action potential is going to develop or not. Right? It's guaranteed. So right in this region here, right, there are also voltage-gated channels. So not only are there ligand-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, but right in the periphery of the neuromuscular junction, there are voltage-gated channels. So as soon as the membrane of this cell depolarizes, that triggers the voltage-gated channels to carry an action potential over the whole surface of the skeletal muscle cell. And it always happens. Because under what kind of control is a skeletal muscle? It's voluntary control, right? So if you think a thought to contract, right, a bunch of flexors in your arm, and the motor signals go down to your brachialis and biceps brachii and cause depolarizations, the biceps brachii and the brachialis should never say, no thank you. What do? They contract because it's under the control of your mind. They have to contract because they have no choice, because those voltage-gated channels reach threshold every single time an action potential reaches the end of that motor neuron. Okay, and that's because this neuromuscular junction is so huge, and the graded potential from the ligand-gated channels doesn't have to travel very far, right? The voltage-gated channels are right on the edge of the neuromuscular junction. So that's another thing. Okay, now, one thing I didn't mention is, what do we call the cell membrane of a muscle cell? That's the sarcolemma. So now you could tell me, what is a similarity between a nerve axon and the sarcolemma of a muscle cell? Well, I was redundant. And the sarcolemma. What's common with the sarcolemma and the membrane of an axon? They have those voltage-gated channels, so that means a skeletal muscle cell, and even a cardiac muscle cell, can transmit action potentials, right? So the basic channel that you need for an action potential is a voltage-gated channel. So muscle and axons are very similar in that respect. What's the big difference between an axon and a muscle cell? Okay. Kind of good guess, kind of good way to think about it, but I could let you think overnight, maybe, or maybe I'll just tell you, all right? Well, they both carry action potentials, but when there's an action potential on a muscle cell, since it's excitable, it contracts. A nerve cell does not contract. Its sole purpose is to, what, transmit an action potential, and its job is done, all right? A muscle cell transmits an action potential, but its job is not done. What does it still have to do? It still has to contract, right? So that process is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. We have to look at the electrical event that starts at the neuromuscular junction and how that results in contraction of a cell, a muscle cell. Okay, so that's a neuromuscular junction. You already have some pretty good models in your mind of how that works, because we looked at, what, a typical chemical synapse. The major difference is that the motor neuron is glued much more effectively to the postsynaptic cell, which is the muscle cell, so that it doesn't pull off. All right, we've looked at motor units in anatomy, at least the definition of a motor unit. And a motor unit is a single efferent motor neuron. Okay, and you can see that's a nice multipolar neuron, right, leaving the ventral root of the spinal cord, and it goes all the way without synapsing to the effector organ, which is going to be skeletal muscle. And as it reaches the skeletal muscle, you can see that it starts to bifurcate and bifurcate again, so that action potentials go to numerous muscle cells, not just to one. Right? So the motor unit is defined as a single motor neuron and all of the individual muscle cells that it stimulates. Okay? All right, and so we can count them. All right, so here is one. Here's a motor unit. How many motor neurons do you see? There's one. And how many muscle fibers get stimulated into contracting when an action potential comes down this axon? Only three, right? So that's what we call the innervation ratio. The innervation ratio is the number of motor neurons, which is pretty much by definition always going to be what number? It's going to be one, right? So it's going to be the number of motor neurons compared to the number of muscle fibers that it stimulates. And this number can vary from one neuron to 100 muscle cells, all the way up to one neuron to 2,000 or thousands of skeletal muscle cells. All right, so what I want you to appreciate is that the innervation ratio depends on the degree of motor control you need to have in a particular part of your body. If you need to have fine discriminative control, right, you need a very small ratio, like 1 to 100 right here, right? So, for instance, what part of your body do you need to have very good motor control over? Huh? Like? Facial muscles, for speaking, right? For breathing and eating, but also what? For communication. And your hands, you need a lot of discriminative control, right? So you have good control over your body. So 1 to 100 would work in that area, but other areas of your body, you don't need to have a lot of control, like postural muscles in your back, right? You don't do a lot, you don't do any typing with your back, right? You do any kind of communication with your back muscles, very little, okay? So you don't need to be doing a lot of different kinds of activities, moving a lot of different ways with the back. All right, so fine control occurs when motor units are small. One motor neuron, when it innervates a small number of fibers. Okay, that gives you fine control in that area. Okay. All right, so let's just think of one muscle cell or one muscle fiber. When action potential comes down the motor neuron and releases acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, that muscle cell is going to contract, right? It has no choice because what kind of potential is developing underneath the neuromuscular junction when an action potential comes down the motor neuron? Is it subthreshold? It is, yeah, it's always going to be threshold. So that skeletal muscle cell is going to contract every single time, and it's going to contract to 100% of its ability to contract. Right, with all of the force that it can generate at that particular time. So what we call that, again, an all or none response, like an action potential, right? So a muscle fiber, a single cell, contracts with an all or none response. It either contracts or it doesn't contract, right? But when you move your body in a certain way, say if I'm going to pick up an object, here is, for instance, a little rubber band. How much tension did my biceps have to generate to pick up this rubber band compared to pick up this water bottle? Is it the same? A lot less. All right, so how is it a muscle like your biceps can generate just a little bit of force or tension versus a lot of tension if a single muscle cell contracts 100% or not at all? Okay. Yeah, so the force of contraction depends on the number of cells within a muscle that contract at the same time. So if you want a really weak contraction, maybe you just get one cell in your arm to contract. If you need a little bit stronger contraction, maybe you get a couple thousand muscle cells to contract. And then if you need to lift something really heavy up, then you need to tell what? Thousands, tens of thousands, or a million cells to contract. And then you can generate a lot of force. But you don't ever want to use all the strength in that muscle to pick up this little rubber band right here, because what would happen? Well, you'd give yourself a bloody nose, right? Okay. So the way that we think about graded contraction in a muscle is what we call recruitment. Right? So a single muscle cell is an all or none response, but a muscle like the biceps has graded contractions because of recruitment. All right, so the brain estimates the number of motor units that are required to stimulate them to contract to pick up an object that you want to pick up. Okay, and so there's some a priori information that you use with your eyes to figure that out, and I bet you've been tricked in your lifetime. I know I have. But it's never really been to any kind of bad end. Have you ever been to a restaurant someplace and they brought a big water bottle over that looked like a big stein that was made out of glass, okay, and is filled with water and ice, and you grab it and you lift it up and all of a sudden it starts flying away because it's not made out of glass. It's what? Made out of plastic. So it's not even half as heavy as compared to the glass mug, right? So you were misled by your eyes. Right, so you recruited a lot of motor units to lift something heavy up, and then as your muscle starts to contract very rapidly, okay, your cerebellum realizes, hey, something isn't happening here, and a number of reflexes take over so you don't throw that water on whoever you went out to dinner with, which is generally a nice thing. Yeah, right. So if I only need one muscle fiber to lift up this rubber band, Okay, that one muscle fiber isn't strong enough to lift up this water bottle, so we have to recruit other muscle fibers to contract to lift something heavier up. Yeah, you look at that and you go, oh yeah, from previous experience, you know. Okay, but if you're fooled, right, you're going to use a lot more force. You're going to over-recruit muscles to lift something up that's very light. Okay. All right, so that's the principle of recruitment. And that's how we explain how there can be an all or none response of a single muscle cell, but yet be able to generate graded tension in a whole muscle, like a brachialis or a biceps brachii. So more and larger motor units are activated to produce greater strength within a muscle contraction, even though every cell has to obey what? The all or none response, right? Okay. All right, so we talked about this a little bit, so we're back to anatomy. Right here we see a muscle fiber, and the building block of a muscle fiber are the contractile organelles. What are these organelles called again? Yeah, myofibrils. And notice that within a myofibril, you have striations. You have this stripe pattern. And even that stripe pattern justifies itself perfectly within all the myofibrils within a cell. All right, so notice that these dark bands right here in this first myofibril line up perfectly with the next, and these line up perfectly with its neighbor, on and on and on, all the way throughout the whole muscle cell. All right, so don't forget, these are the organelles within inside a muscle fiber. And so we want to now start looking at some of the building blocks of a myofibril. And the two contractile proteins are what? Those thick and thin filaments. What's the thick filament? Myosin, and the thin filament is the actin. So these are the proteins for muscle contraction. All right, so I'm going to soon ask you, since muscle is specialized to contract, which ones, or maybe both of those proteins, actually shorten when a muscle shortens? Okay, so let's look at shortening a little bit. All right, so the structural and functional unit. I think we've gone over structural and functional unit a couple times in here. What's a structural and functional unit of life? A cell. What's another structural and functional unit? Ah, synapse. What's a, yeah, oh no, that's, the synapse is a structural and functional unit of what? Communication between cells, right? So there are chemical synapses, electrical synapses, okay. So here is another structural and functional unit of contraction, and it is a sarcomere. So if you know how a sarcomere is put together and how a single sarcomere contracts, then you pretty much know how a whole muscle contracts, skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and with a little modification, even how smooth muscle contracts. All right, so here we have a sarcomere. The definition of a sarcomere by its structure is from Z-disc to Z-disc. All right, so these are the ends of a sarcomere. And so there's some connective tissue and proteins in here that make up these Z-discs. So it just kind of looks like a line, but don't forget, a muscle is a three-dimensional object, and the Z-disc goes all the way through from one end of a myofibril to the other. Attached to the Z-discs are the thin filaments. This is probably pretty important to realize, and these are the actin filaments attached to the Z-discs. And in this area right here, where we only have actin filaments, light passes through this area very easily. Right? And we call this the I band right here. And if we look at a micrograph, I can see the light areas right here. This is an I band from right here all the way to right here, and right in the middle is a Z disc. So an I band goes from one sarcomere into the next one. Do I see I band label? Oh yeah, right here. Here's an I band, right, on a micrograph. So we're going to develop an eye to see how these things move when a muscle contracts. All right, the other kind of contractile protein is the thick filament, otherwise known as myosin. The myosin, you can see, as opposed to actin, is anchored right smack in the middle of a sarcomere. And the band, all right, when it has these thick filaments in there, doesn't transmit light very well. So we call that the dark band or A band. So isn't that nice the way these letters work out? I stands for light, right? Because there's an I in light. There's an A in dark, right? So that's really easy to remember. That's not exactly why they got named that way, but it has to do with the way polarized light moves through these different regions. But that certainly works for you in terms of the test and labeling these kinds of things, right? So here is the A band, and then here is the I band. Right smack in the middle, all right, of the A band, right, we call this the M line. There are some proteins that anchor the myosin right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. So these are little anchor points right here. The zone from the tip of neighboring actin proteins within a sarcomere we call the H zone. And this is, it has an intermediate kind of intensity associated with it. So the light band is very light. The dark bands, where you see overlap of actin and myosin, are extremely dark. But where we only have myosin right smack in the middle, you can see is what? Not quite as dark as the dark band, but not quite as light as the light band. Right? Because it only has myosin, not actin. All right? So we call that the H zone. All right, so that's got some interesting proteins. The other, only other protein that I don't see on this diagram, and here we got it, another protein, is this titin molecule right here. Okay, titin, you can see, kind of looks like a spring, right? And the titin goes from the Z disc all the way through the myosin, and it kind of helps the orientation of the myosin molecule, holds it in the middle of the sarcomere. But what can you do with a spring? What's a good model of a spring? What can you do with a spring? Like maybe a spring on a gate you have or a door at your house. All right? Yeah, you can open the door that stretches the spring, and when you let go of the door, what does it do? It goes back. And so what kind of property do we call that? That is, yeah, recoil, or elasticity is the proper, right, proper term. So muscle exhibits elasticity, meaning that when you stretch muscle, it automatically goes back to its resting length. It doesn't have to contract, right? So this titin molecule right here is not important for contraction, right? It only allows a muscle, when it's relaxed, to go back to its resting length. But it can't really contract. It can't pull on an object. If an object starts to pull on that spring or the titin protein, guess what it does? It stretches, right? So titin doesn't contract. It only brings a resting muscle back to its original length. All right, so what did I miss right here? Couple other little things. Notice that the actin filaments are made up of these little balls right here, right? So actin really isn't a long filament, but it's made up of all these globular proteins, or G-actin, that are glued together. They're like a string of pearls right here. All right, so that might be important for you to realize in a little bit. Okay. Now let's see how sarcomeres are put together in three dimensions. All right, so one of these things is an exam figure that you have to be able to label for sure, right? Like the I band and the A band and the H band and the M line, you have to know. Okay. So what's next to every myosin molecule? What's above a myosin molecule, if we look at this diagram? An actin. And what's below a myosin molecule? Another actin, right? All right, but now let's take a three-dimensional myofibril, okay, and cut it on end like this, all right, and then let's look at it on edge. So we're looking at it on end right here. So we have some dots that are really thick. All right. So what kind of protein has this that gives us this big thick dot right here? That's myosin. Okay. And then if we look around this myosin, what surrounds every myosin protein? Right. In three dimensions, myosin is surrounded by actin. And actin is what? These little tiny dots right here. Can you even see them on the screen? Probably. Okay, I can see them on the computer monitor. All right. Now, if you look at an actin molecule, what is it surrounded by? Look over here. A myosin. And what's on the other side? A myosin. So the arrangement of actin and myosin is that they surround each other. All right. So that's a very important property of actin and myosin. The model of how a sarcomere shortens is okay if you think about it in one dimension, but actually maybe contemplate it in three dimensions, right? Realizing that for every myosin, it's surrounded by actin, and every actin is surrounded by myosin. So there's going to be a special association with actin and myosin when this sarcomere contracts. All right, so I think we're ready to look and see how a sarcomere actually contracts. All right, and the model that we use in our mind is what we call the sliding filament theory of contraction. All right, so what's the difference between a theory and a hypothesis? Yeah, hypothesis is a guess, or it might be something that you could kind of, yeah, just take a guess on how it works, but a theory is something that's been proven by all kinds of different kinds of experiments, right? So what we're going to talk about, and as a matter of fact, in this class, pretty much the only thing we talk about are theories, right? If it's a hypothesis, I tell you that it's just a guess. So this is a nice theory that's been shown to be true by numerous kinds of experiments. All right, so muscle contracts because myofibrils get shorter. What the heck is a myofibril again? It's a myofibril. It's the organelle of contraction inside of a muscle cell, and a muscle fiber has many of them, right? Many. I don't know what the range of the numbers is. Somebody should Google that and tell me. How many myofibrils does a skeletal muscle have? Maybe it depends on what part of the body it is. Okay. All right. Well, shortening occurs because the thin filaments slide over and between the thick filaments toward the center. Remember, the thin filaments are anchored to, oh yeah, is that the sign-in sheet up there that's starting to go around? Yeah? No?
Yeah.
Yeah? Thank you. Yeah, keep passing it around.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so don't forget, the actins are attached to the Z-discs. And when the myofibril starts to contract, the actin filaments get pulled to the center of the sarcomere without being released from the Z-discs, so the Z-discs get pulled closer to the center of the sarcomere. So the Z-discs come closer together. Okay, so that's important to realize. So here we have a couple pictures. All right, so here's a Z-disc here. So here is one sarcomere, and then here is a nice illustration for you to see the arrangement of actin and myosin. All right, so what do we call this band right here, from here to here? That's the dark band, or you should know it as A, right? A in dark. And what kind of proteins do we have? Yeah, myosin, right? And maybe a little overlap of actin right in this region right here. All right, we got the H zone where there is no overlap of actin. All right, so this first picture right here is of two sarcomeres when they're relaxed. Right, the second picture is when what is happening? You can see the Z-discs are being pulled closer together, so this shows that the muscle is actually starting to contract. And then this last picture right here, you can see definitely what? The Z-discs are a lot closer together. And so don't forget, this happens for all of the thousands of sarcomeres that you have within the myofibril. And all of the myofibrils within a skeletal muscle cell. So this generates a tremendous amount of force. All right, so what zones disappear as this muscle contracts? Okay, look at this H zone right here. It's gotten smaller and it completely goes away. What about this I band? All right, I see it right here. And look, it gets a little bit shorter in this picture, and then finally, what happens to it down here? Completely disappears. All right, so the I band also goes away. All right, so that was a really good clue as to how a sarcomere contracts. So let's look at the nice illustration where it's easier to see. And you might want to get a ruler out sometime and look in your book, because I can't put a ruler on this picture right here. But let's go over some of the important details. Can you tell that the sarcomere in case number one is a lot longer than the sarcomere in case number two? Right? Because what's a sarcomere? From Z to Z. And you can see it's a lot shorter. And is that sarcomere even shorter in the third case? Absolutely. Right? All right. So one is long, two is short, and three is even the shortest. Now, look at the length of this actin molecule. How many arrows could I put there? One, two, three, four, like maybe six arrows? Okay. What about the length of this actin compared to the length of this actin in the second picture? Is it shorter? You perceive any shortening right there? Okay, you should not. All right, what about the length of actin in the third case? It should be the same length as during in a resting muscle. So the actin length is the same. So if I were to ask you, does actin contract when a sarcomere contracts? You would have to say, there's no evidence for that. It looks the same length. So you might say, well, if actin doesn't contract, maybe myosin actually shortens when a sarcomere contracts. So let's look. Here's the length when the muscle is relaxed. What's the length when it's starting to contract? Looks like it's the same. And then what about when this muscle is fully contracted? It's the same length. So again, right, myosin doesn't contract when the Z discs come together. All right, now how could you explain why these Z discs come together? Because that I band goes away. So what does that mean? It means that myosin is actually pulling the Z disc closer and closer to the M line, and these filaments are just sliding over each other. So a good way to see that would be maybe with these two markers right here. All right, can I make these markers shorter? Could I get them to contract? There's no way, right? They're too stiff. All right, so if I put them end to end, this could be the definition of a sarcomere with the Z discs on the end. All right, so how could we bring these Z discs, okay, together? Okay, we could allow these proteins that won't shorten to just slide over or telescope over each other, and look what happens to the Z discs. Right, they approximate each other. They get pulled in toward the midline. And then when a muscle relaxes, what happens? Actin and myosin slide past each other again, and the muscle relaxes. So that's the sliding filament mechanism. But don't forget, this doesn't happen in one dimension. It's happening what? 360 degrees around every myosin molecule and actin molecule. All right. So here is just some pros of what we've just discussed so far. So I don't think I want to read these things to you. All right, so this is just a synopsis of what we just talked about. All right, but we got to get into some more detail about how actin and myosin interact with each other. This is really important for physiology. So let's really zoom in to just look at one actin myofilament and one myosin myofilament. All right, so here is an actin. That's the thin filament. Down here is the myosin. And here are all the G proteins. These are the globular actins that have been put together. But we see some other compounds associated with the actin filament. We have some long filamentous proteins that lie right on top of the globular proteins. This long protein right here is what we call tropomyosin. And we see a third protein, which is a lot shorter, and it's associated with the tropomyosin in a couple locations, and we call this troponin. And troponin is going to be a similar kind of compound compared to calmodulin. Where have you run into calmodulin before? What's calmodulin do? It likes to buddy up. It likes to pair up with something. Calcium. That's right. And that's where it got its name from, right? From calcium. So troponin is a cousin molecule to calmodulin. So you should get the idea that troponin likes to bind calcium. Okay, we're going to come back to that in a second. All right, so here is the myosin. Myosin has some fine structures on it that we call cross bridges, right? And a cross bridge has one long piece that we call the myosin tail that projects up away from the major body of the myosin protein. Then there's a head group, myosin head group, and the myosin head group has got a couple different areas associated with it. It's got a binding site for ATP. It also has another binding site right on the tip of the head right here, which is what we call an actin binding site. So that pretty much describes where this part of the myosin head group likes to bind. It likes to bind to actin. All right, so this tip of the head group can bind to an actin molecule. And then you also have this active site for ATP. And this active site right here will hydrolyze ATP. And when ATP is hydrolyzed, what does that release? Okay, it releases ADP and inorganic phosphate. This is true, but I'm thinking in a little bit more ethereal terms. It releases energy, right? And what does energy allow you to do? What's a good definition for energy? It allows you to do work, like muscle contraction, right? Or move chemicals around inside your body via vesicular transport, for instance. Okay. All right, so in order for a muscle to contract, this actin binding site on myosin has to bind to a particular site on the actin filament. How do we always describe the binding of two molecules to each other? What has to be proper? The shape, right? So the shape of the binding site has to be complementary to the shape of the ligand that's going to bind to it. And where it binds is on each of these actin globules right here. But when the muscle is at rest, tropomyosin is covering up the binding sites so that the actin binding site on myosin just doesn't have access, can't bind to it. All right, so this right here is a picture of a muscle cell pretty much at rest because the cross bridge from myosin to actin isn't formed. Okay. And what this ATP does is, what's the difference between this cross bridge here and this cross bridge over here? The one on the left compared to the one on the right. Okay, one has ATP on it. The other has ADP and inorganic phosphate, and that means that energy has been released. But look at the shape of the cross bridge. It is bent in this first condition, but what is it like over here? It is straight. So the myosin cross bridge undergoes what? A conformation change when ATP is hydrolyzed. It goes from this bent position to the straight position. Okay. All right. So let me tell you how the filaments slide over each other. All right, so here we have actin, and the muscle has been allowed, and we're going to talk about this next, to contract. So that means that the cross bridge can associate itself with this actin. So what has had to happen? This tropomyosin had to get out of the way. All right, we're going to talk about that process next. Once it's out of the way, the actin binding site can bind to, guess what there has to be on this actin molecule? There's got to be a myosin binding site, right? So here's the actin binding site, and then there's a myosin binding site over here. Okay, when the tropomyosin gets out of the way, this thing has been cocked because ATP has been hydrolyzed, all right? And then when inorganic phosphate is released, right, from the ATP binding site, then this myosin cross bridge goes back to its original conformation, which is what? Instead of being straight, it goes back to being in a cocked position right here. We see it. And when it moves, right, when it ratchets over, it pulls this actin myosin to the right or toward the middle of the sarcomere. All right, so this is what we call the power stroke in muscle contraction. And you should know what it's caused by. So what causes this change in conformation from being straight to being cocked like this? What do you see? What's the only difference?
The
All right. I hope this is this color the same as this color right here? Yeah. All right. So this is ADP. This is ADP right here. What's missing over here? Inorganic phosphate. So as soon as inorganic phosphate leaves the binding site, that changes the conformation of the myosin cross bridge, and it pulls the actin molecule toward midline. We call that the power stroke. And that's due to inorganic phosphate release, right? So PI is inorganic phosphate. And don't forget, that's a pretty big molecule. That's got a phosphate atom and four oxygens and a couple of hydrogens, right? So that's a pretty big molecule when it leaves. So don't be surprised if that causes a conformation change in the cross bridge. All right, so this is the whole cross bridge cycle. All right, so let's start with this case right here. All right, so the cross bridge is in a straight conformation because here I see ADP and inorganic phosphate, so that means what? ATP has been hydrolyzed. And when that ATP is hydrolyzed, it causes the straightening of this cross bridge. All right. And then the head group can bind to actin, which we see right here. After it binds to actin, inorganic phosphate is released. And what does that cause when inorganic phosphate is released? That causes the power stroke, and that slides the actin over the myosin filament. Okay. The other thing that happens, then ADP is released from the binding site, so now we have a binding site that has nothing in it. So what can fit in this place right now? ATP comes in. Okay. Now here is an important feature of muscles. Notice when ADP is released, what can you tell me about the relationship of myosin and actin when this ATP goes away? I mean the ADP is released. Myosin and actin are still attached to each other. Okay? So the power stroke really doesn't have anything to do with what the release of myosin from actin, and the release of ADP doesn't cause the release of actin and myosin. But look what happens when an ATP binds to the myosin head group. So it binds, and look what happens. You get release of myosin from actin only when there is ATP present. Okay. And so we use this fact, okay, to describe what happens to somebody's muscles when they run out of ATP. And that happens, of course, when you die and the ATP is all used up in your muscles. And what happens to somebody maybe an hour or two after death? Their muscles are completely contracted. We call that rigor mortis, right? So there's not ATP to contract muscle. It just means that there's no ATP in those cells to cause the release of actin and myosin from each other, right? So rigor mortis is not an active condition. Really, it's just a passive condition that prevents the release of myosin from actin. Okay. All right, so I do want you to know that. And then this cycle just repeats itself. So the important things for you to know is the power stroke is caused by inorganic phosphate release, right? The cocking of this cross bridge right here occurs when ATP is hydrolyzed into ADP and inorganic phosphate. Notice that it straightens out. And the release of actin from myosin occurs when ATP binds to the head group. So those are pretty much the three important characteristics that you should be familiar with. Okay, so you know what? I need to bail out of here and come over to here, okay, and I'll play a little video, all right, so that you can see what's happening here, maybe a little bit better picture. Well, what do we got? Hopefully, you can see this is something very close, resembles what we've been talking about. What do we got between Z-line and Z-line? We got a sarcomere. We've got these filaments made out of all these globular proteins. This is an actin filament. We got these thick ones that are myosin, and we see cross bridges right here, and it looks like they're already attached to the actin, right? So here's the H zone and the A band. You can practice labeling these things. This is not a really long video. Let's see if we can hear what's going on.
Myofilaments are side by side, and the H zones and I band are at maximum width. During contraction, the actin and myosin myofilaments interact. The actins are pulled towards the center of each.
All right, so do you see the articulation of the myosin head group pulling on the actins, and then it releases, then it gets cocked, it reaches out ahead again, grabs an actin, and then goes through the power stroke, releases over and over again. But don't forget, this doesn't happen in one dimension. It happens within, what, three dimension in all of those different filaments in a myofibril.
Each myosin myofilament. As a result, the sarcomere is shortened. In the fully contracted muscle, the ends of the actin myofilaments overlap, the H zones disappear, and the I band becomes very narrow.
Okay. So, you'll have the links in Blackboard if you want to review that some. All right, let's go back to the PowerPoint. All right, so now we just have to talk a little bit about some other things. Okay, control of contraction. What allows, because skeletal muscle is under your voluntary control. All right, so something's got to allow the sliding of myofilaments, and something should stop the sliding of myofilaments when you need to relax. All right, anybody need the sign-in sheet? I'll have it down here after class. All right, so what kind of filament does this look like to you right here? Actin, because of all of these globular proteins, these are the G-actins. Then here's a long filamentous tropomyosin, right? And then here is the troponin complex. And the tropomyosin is now covering up the myosin binding site. So myosin can't bind to these G-actins right here at this particular point in time. But don't forget, tropomyosin is a cousin molecule to calmodulin. So troponin is a cousin molecule to calmodulin. So that means that it likes to bind calcium. And when it binds calcium, it changes conformation. And since it's associated with tropomyosin, it's going to cause a conformation change in tropomyosin. And it's going to move out of the way, and it's going to reveal the actin or the myosin binding sites on these G-actin proteins right here. All right, so let's see if I have a picture. All right. So here we have troponin. We can see it associated with tropomyosin. This cross bridge has hydrolyzed ATP already, so it's been cocked. It's ready to bind to the myosin binding site. And when this muscle is relaxed, there's no calcium bound right here, so the tropomyosin is covering up these binding sites, so there can't be a cross bridge formed between actin and myosin. But as soon as calcium levels increase within the myofibril, look at this site right here. This is a calcium binding site. So when calcium levels increase inside the cell, binds to troponin, troponin pushes tropomyosin out of the way. Look, it used to be down over here. Now where is it? It's way up over here. And so a cross bridge can form. So now actin and myosin are attached to each other. And when inorganic phosphate is released, look what happens to the cross bridge. What do we call this activity of going from straight to bent again? Straight to bent is what we call power stroke. That's caused by PI release, and when that happens, actin slides over the myosin filament. All right, so the controlling molecule is calcium. All right, so you learned a lot about electrolytes and their functions inside the cell. Here is calcium once again. All right, so what other processes are important? Or what other processes does calcium play an important role for? Synaptic transmission, right? Calcium has to enter the synaptic terminal to allow the fusion and docking of synaptic vesicles and release of neurotransmitter, right? So there'd be no chemical synapse interaction without the proper levels of calcium in your body. And here we see not only synaptic transmission, but Muscle contraction is dependent on the proper levels of calcium inside cells. What's another important function for calcium? Bone structure, right? To make bones strong. All right. So if you're low on calcium, which of those processes would you sacrifice? Yeah, bones. That's like the last place your body is concerned about having the proper calcium, because you need it for muscle contraction. If you can't contract muscles, how long can you live for? Maybe a couple of minutes, because you can't breathe, right? And you need it for synaptic transmission. You wouldn't be able to control anything in your body without the proper levels of calcium. So calcium in bones is really just a reservoir for calcium for many other important functions. All right, so again, that really emphasizes, you know, the etiology of osteoporosis, because your body doesn't really need to have proper levels of calcium in bones compared to other places. Okay, so now we got to talk about, how does that calcium get inside these myofibrils right here to bind to troponin, to get tropomyosin out of the way, so that actin and myosin can form a cross bridge, all right, and slide past each other. All right, but we got to review something about the internal structure of a skeletal muscle. All right, so you got to become familiar. If you forgot these details, you got to go back, open up your anatomy book. So here we see the sarcolemma. And why is this sarcolemma just like a neuron? As a part, in particular, why is it just like an axon? What has it got? It's got voltage-gated channels. So it can pass an action potential over the surface of the cell. All right, but there is a difference between a muscle cell and a nerve cell, because look at these holes right here. These enter into what we call a transverse tubule. And there are voltage-gated channels in these transverse tubules, and they take an action potential from the surface of the cell and transmit it where? Deep into the interior of a muscle cell and spreads it around. Right? So here is a transverse tubule taking all that electrical information throughout the whole interior of the cell. Right? And then we see the myofibrils over here. Surrounding myofibrils, we have some kind of special smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Right? Because we call this smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Why? What's it missing? No ribosomes. So it's not specialized for protein synthesis. This kind of smooth endoplasmic reticulum is specialized to be a reservoir for calcium ions. So there are calcium pumps all over these membranes right here that are taking calcium from within the cell, including the myofibrils, and pumping it back into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So what does a pump do? How can it move calcium if it's a pump? It can move it from... It's active transport, if it's a pump, means it can take it from low concentration and put it into high concentration. So those pumps can actually take pretty much all the calcium that's inside the muscle myofibril and put it back into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. But in a muscle cell, we call that the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Anytime you hear that sarco, you should think of a muscle cell of some kind. All right, so when the cell's at rest, those calcium pumps pump all the calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And so you can see the sarcoplasmic reticulum completely surrounds the myofibril, but there's a special association between the transverse tubule and the sarcoplasmic reticulum. This part of the sarcoplasmic reticulum we call a terminal cisternae. You can see it's a little bit thicker, so it holds a lot more calcium than these other parts. Right, and they're running parallel to the transverse tubules. So when an action potential comes down a transverse tubule, and where did that action potential come from? The sarcolemma, and then it came from the neuromuscular junction, because there are voltage-gated channels right there at the neuromuscular junction. Right, when that action potential comes down the transverse tubule, that causes the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. A massive release of calcium. It floods the myofibril. And what does it do inside that myofibril? Let's go back. It binds to troponin, and that pulls tropomyosin out of the way, so that cross bridges can form between myosin and actin. And as long as there's ATP, you can have what, that cross bridge cycle and the myofilaments sliding over each other, causing the shortening of the sarcomere. So that's what we call excitation-contraction coupling. There's only a couple other little details, which I'm sure you're going to find really interesting. All right, so here is a really good illustration of the neuromuscular junction, right, the sarcolemma, and here's the sarcoplasmic reticulum with a nice T-tubule right here. All right, so when an action potential comes down, that causes what? Calcium to enter the Bhutan terminale, causes, right, the fusion and docking of the synaptic vesicle, release of neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter moves across the neuromuscular junction and it binds to, that looks like a pretty nice nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. That opens up a sodium channel. So sodium enters the cell. What do we call that when sodium enters the cell? Depolarization, right? So that's a nice electrical event that triggers these guys right here. These are voltage-gated channels, right? And that's what you need for an action potential. What are some characteristics of an action potential? How are they transmitted? All or none response without degradation, right? So an action potential sweeps over the whole cell membrane because you have voltage-gated channels everywhere. Right, so in that sense, a muscle cell is acting just like a neuron, right, including these T-tubules. You can see voltage-gated channels right here. And so the action potential moves down the T-tubule, but now we see some other fascinating kinds of membrane proteins within the T-tubule. All right, this first one right here, all right, this is a voltage-gated channel that we call a DHP channel, or a dihydropyridine receptor. Right? When the membrane potential changes, this thing changes conformation. The DHP receptor changes conformation, all right, just like these voltage-gated channels change conformation when the voltage changes. But these are connected to a protein in the sarcoplasmic reticulum membrane. Right, and these are what we call ryanodine receptors. So you got a complex of two receptors right here, the DHP receptor and a ryanodine. And this is the fascinating thing about these receptors. Look at the spatial relationship between a DHP and a ryanodine receptor. What can you tell me about them? Is there a big space between them? They actually look like they're touching each other. Right, and indeed they are. So when there's a conformation change in the DHP receptor, it's going to pull on the ryanodine receptor, and the ryanodine receptor is just a mechanical receptor. And when it gets pulled, it gets opened up, and what happens to calcium? It flows down by diffusion from super high concentration to low concentration. All right, and as calcium is released from the cell, there are even some other channels that open up, which are called calcium-induced calcium release channels. And these things are huge. They're about 10 times the diameter of a regular calcium channel. So what does that mean for the movement of calcium into the myofibril? When a super large channel opens, right, then you can even get a bigger flood of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum into the myofibril. And that's really what initiates the sliding of the filaments over each other. All right, so I do want you to know these different kinds of receptors on the T-tubule membrane and the sarcoplasmic reticular membrane. And the interesting thing is, what, the ryanodine is what we call an electromechanical release mechanism. So how would you open up that door over there? Is it open right now? Yeah. It's open right now. But if it were closed, how would you get outside the room? Yeah, you would just push it open. And the interesting thing is that's exactly how a ryanodine receptor works. All right, when it's pushed by the DHP receptor right here. And this DHP receptor is just waiting for an electrical signal, namely an action potential, to come down the T-tubule. And then the ryanodine receptor gets pulled, allows calcium to move out, and that's the signal for forming cross bridges between actin and myosin. Okay, so that's another kind of receptor. So we looked at ligand-gated channels, we looked at voltage-gated channels, and here's even another one. This is what? A mechanically controlled channel, and it's pulled on by the DHP receptor. All right, so here's a little synopsis of excitation-contraction coupling. So let's go over this really quick. All right, so what kind of neuron can be used to excite a muscle cell, a skeletal muscle cell? Yeah, a voluntary or a somatic motor neuron. All right, so an action potential reaches the axon terminus, and that's going to cause release of acetylcholine, because again, calcium enters the axon terminus. All right, and this is at the neuromuscular junction. Acetylcholine binds to the typical kind of nicotinic receptor that you're familiar with. All right, that's just a ligand-gated channel. That opens that channel, so now sodium diffuses in, and that's what we call depolarization. And that always produces a threshold stimulus because the neuromuscular junction is huge. It releases a lot of acetylcholine. All right, so that means that an action potential is always produced by what kind of channels? Voltage-gated channels that are on the periphery of the neuromuscular junction, and that action potential is conducted along the whole sarcolemma because it's got voltage-gated channels. Even the T-tubules have voltage-gated channels, so action potential not only stays on the surface of the cell, but it dives deep down into the cell. Okay, and then because of these DHP receptors, action potentials open the pull on the DHP receptors, which are coupled to calcium channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and those are, that coupling mechanism is the ryanodine receptor that pulls on the calcium release channel, so now you have a huge amount of calcium entering the myofibrils. Oops, here's the last little bullet right here. All right, and then calcium binds to troponin. And when calcium binds to troponin, I don't have it on the slide right here, what happens? Tropomyosin gets pulled out of the way. Myosin can now associate with actin, and as long as there's ATP, it can go through the cross-bridge cycling, and actin and myosin will slide over each other. All right, so definitely look at this right before Monday. Ask me some questions. Muscle relaxation then is basically just the opposite process. All right, when there are no action potentials on the sarcolemma, then the calcium release channels close and the calcium pumps in the sarcoplasmic reticulum start pumping calcium from within the myofibril back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and that pulls calcium off of troponin. Tropomyosin covers up the binding site and cross bridges can't cycle anymore, and then actin and myosin slide past each other back to the resting position. What pulls actin and myosin back to the resting position again? There's a protein in the sarcomere that pulls actin and myosin back to their resting position. And it's called the titin molecule, right? That little spring thing in there? That little springy thing? Okay. So that's excitation-contraction coupling. So, what else do I want you to see? Okay.
Myofilaments are composed of strands of the proteins actin and myosin. An actin filament has two strands of actin molecules wrapped together. A myosin filament has many myosin proteins packed together, and each myosin protein has a globular head region that protrudes from the filament. Myofilaments can contract or shorten due to interactions between the myosin head and the actin filaments. Contraction begins with the head of myosin molecules bound to actin on the actin filament. While still bound to actin, the myosin head flexes, pulling the actin filament along with it.
So did you see how actin just slid right over the top of myosin? Okay, what's that called when it goes from straight to cocked? Power stroke. What causes that? Release of inorganic phosphate, yeah.
This causes the actin filament to slide by the myosin filament. Then the myosin head releases from the actin and
What causes release? When it binds ATP, right? So ADP has to be released. ATP binds, it releases. And then it straightens out again when ATP is hydrolyzed. Right? When ATP is hydrolyzed, then it recocks itself.
Unflexes, a change that is powered by ATP. This frees the myosin head to bind with a different actin molecule farther up the actin filament. The entire process may then be repeated many times. The myosin, in effect, walks along the actin filament, moving the actin filament more each time.
All right, so that's a pretty good video. Did we see this one
already?
Yeah, we saw that one already.
Actin and myosin myofilaments lie side by side, and the H zones and I band are at maximum width.
During contraction of a muscle, calcium ions bind to troponin. This moves tropomyosin out of the way and uncovers binding sites for myosin on the actin myofilament. ADP and phosphate are attached to the myosin head from the previous cycle of movement. The myosin head attached to the exposed binding sites on the actin myofilaments to form cross bridges, and the phosphate is released. Energy stored in the head of the myosin myofilament is used to move the head. This causes the actin myofilament to slide past the myosin myofilament. The ADP is released from the myosin head as it moves. The bond between actin and the myosin head is broken when an ATP molecule binds to the myosin head. The ATP is broken down to ADP and phosphate, releasing energy, which is stored in the myosin head and will be used later for movement. The head of the myosin molecule returns to its upright position and is ready to bind to actin again. If calcium ions are still present, the entire sequence is repeated.
Okay, so there's some pretty good pictures, and you'll have the links, and you can look at these other animations there as well. All right, so that's it for today. See you Thursday. Here's the sign-in sheet.